everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to our show at restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how you doing?
I'm doing well this morning, but I think we need to start our show with a little bit of... We got this wrong.
Well, a long time ago. We've clarified since, but I really want to clarify even more.
When agave was first presented, agave nectar, it was presented to the American public as a sweetener. We advocated for, well, we pointed it out and we suggested you go try it. It actually is quite interesting as an alternative sweetener to in cocktails, in baking, it behaves interestingly, and it's pretty interesting. And it
and
has
now
been
we're abdicating, advocating.
Well, that's really tough. That actually might be correct. I can't get my head all the way around that. It has been presented as a natural and alternative sweetener to the American palate, and it turns out that it really is not what it seems to be.
And, you know, Francis and I, again, we've mentioned this in passing a few times, but there was a great article on realfoodforager.com that really hits all the points that we were kind of sure about but didn't know completely about.
And it turns out this whole agave nectar, what brilliant marketing that is, right, agave nectar? It's not really anything traditional in Mexican.
It's not nectar
cuisine. Yeah, it was developed in the 1990s, and it is made in Mexico from agave. And according to the article at realfoodforager.com, Russ Bianchi, who's an executive of a large beverage development company, he gave a lecture recently at the Weston Price MythBusters conference in the fall, and he talked all about and demonstrated what agave was. It was developed in the 90s. There's no such thing as agave nectar in traditional Mexican cuisine. The juice is expressed from the core of the agave. It's then filtered, heated to hydrolyze the polysaccharides into simple sugars. The filtered, hydrolyzed juice is then concentrated into a syrupy liquid, slightly thinner than honey. It's highly processed. They use caustic acids, clarifiers as filtration chemicals, and it results in a syrup that is 70 to 92% pure fructose. Now, high fructose corn syrup is 55% fructose. So you have a very high fructose, very processed thing. I want to point out, to be fair, white sugar is a pretty highly processed item. Okay, so, you know, unless you're talking about evaporated cane juice, which is really the way that you could get simple cane sugar, making your table sugar is a process. Okay, so but there's a difference between, you know, sugar like that, evaporated cane juice, and high fructose corn syrup. And I think the way this was presented in the market, people would think that, I mean,
it was a natural alternative. And that's kind of what Francis and I assumed when we first saw this product in the marketplace.
And look, if you sell me peach nectar, what that means is it's peach juice. And, you know, so what I'm thinking in agave nectar is that it's basically
reduced agave juice.
A liquid taken from the agave that is then reduced. And that's not what it is. And that's why we need to point that out. And at the frightening 70 to 92% pure fructose. There's a lot of folks out there who feel the debate is still ongoing as to whether high fructose corn syrup is any different than sugar or not. But when we talk about fructose,
we're not two of those people.
Yeah, exactly. There's a book out called The Agave Nectar, Worse Than We Thought, by Sally Fallon and Ramey Nagel. And they write that obese people who drank fructose-sweetened drinks with a meal wound up with a blood triglyceride level 200 times higher than equally obese people who drank glucose-sweetened drinks.
So you didn't say 200% higher.
No, 200
Which would be two times higher. You said 200 times higher.
Yeah, 200 times 100%, which is, what is that, 20,000%?
20,000%.
Yeah. So, look, they can sell whatever they want, but nectar, to me, said something different, and I need to come out here and point out that that's not what we thought it was. There is an agave sweetener from the agave plant that's traditionally used in Mexico. It's mostly used as a medicine. It's called miel de agave or miel de maguey. Maguey is the Oaxacan word for the plant, the agave plant. And it's actually made from the sap of the agave plant. And then it's boiled for hours and reduced, like a maple syrup might be reduced. And see, that's what I thought agave syrup always was.
That's exactly what we thought it was. By the way, Francis and I are getting some in, so we'll have it at the bars for somebody to taste if you want to try it.
Yeah, so miel de agave or miel de maguey is a dark, thick liquid with characteristic smell and strong flavor. And it's used to treat illnesses in traditional medicine. It has a high concentration of mineral salts like calcium and magnesium and sodium and potassium, as well as amino acids. And it has been consumed since pre-Hispanic times. And here's this is the telling thing about the article we're going to have behind the bar, but you might not like it. It's a quite a different substance than the agave nectar marketed as the healthy alternative sugar is. And what they write is, this agave has a deep, intense flavor that most people, and I love this, would not relish. So they sort of imply that you might sort of like it, but I don't relish it. But I think what they mean is it's gross.
Can I go off topic for one second?
Yeah.
The word relish.
Yeah.
Okay. You can put relish on your hot dog.
Yeah, different kind of relish.
I always hated relish, though. I always thought, what a terrible word for that.
First of all, you were eating the crappy canned relish.
Secondly, I guess that's true.
Secondly, verb, noun, very different. They've migrated apart. Yeah, so we're getting some in. We don't intend to relish it, but we'll never know. And you know what? I'm really interested in trying. A lot of things that are medicinal
absolutely
wind up being fantastic cocktail ingredients.
I was just about to say that. You know, it may turn out, and it may not. It may not. Francis and I have not experimented with this yet. It may turn out that in small quantities that it may give you some flavor profile that's really great when mixed with other flavor profiles.
And we're going to find out, God damn it. the examples that come to mind are bitters, you know, whether they're potable bitters or non-potable bitters. But, you know, Averna Amaro, you know, give that to your 9-year-old. See if he likes it. And you're like, oh, I'll drink it straight, but I'm in another life I was an Italian man with a beret sitting in the plaza playing checkers.
You were a bitter hound.
Yeah, I was. But so I just want to get that out there. Miel de agave or miel de maguey are not agave nectar. One is an industrial product. The other one is maple syrup. So just forewarned is forearmed. Listen, stick with us. We have a great guest coming up in just a second, and you'll have to come back to find out. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Barbara Stuckey. She is a professional food developer. She is with Mattson, North America's largest independent developer of new foods, and she has written a book. It's called Taste, What You're Missing by Barb Stuckey.
Barb, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're a food inventor.
That's right.
Food's already been invented, Barb.
Yes, we work for companies both large and small, some of the largest food companies in the world, restaurant chains, and then entrepreneurs who want to get into the food business, or in the case of the large companies, want to get into new food businesses. And so we come up with the ideas and what opportunity they should be pursuing, what food format it should take, how they should market it, and then we do the prototyping here in our lab in Northern California, and we make the ideas come to life with edible prototypes.
Barb, I want our listeners to know, just so they don't think that we're doing something outside the box, you wrote an awesome book. Otherwise, with that particular resume, you probably would not have been a guest on this particular show.
You deal in an area of the food world that's just something that we aren't concerned with. You know, we tend to stay away from processed foods and highly processed foods, but there are a huge amount of the food that we eat. And your experience, and I want to talk about your experience because it has informed this really smart, really wonderful book that can help everyone appreciate the food they eat better. I mean, there are things that I learned in reading the book that were fantastic. But tell us about, mostly you're dealing with, in your professional life, processed foods, right?
Yes, I am. I think you could safely say that. But I also want to remind you that some of the most famous, most delicious things in the world are processed. Cheese, for example, is processed. Wine is processed.
Well,
Chocolate is processed. Coffee is processed.
I would agree with
not necessarily a bad word.
You know what? I would agree with all of those things. But Pop-Tarts are also processed, and that's a little and that's in a different category of food. And I'm not saying don't ever eat a Pop-Tart. I'm saying that there's a distinction here. And what people need to realize is that in the corporate world, people put a lot of, and what I was really amazed at is you talk in your book about some, you looked for a book to talk about taste. You looked for a book that you realized that you were talking to clients who really couldn't analyze tastes as well as you could. And this book is to help raise awareness overall. I mean, what led you to write this book, realizing that most people don't understand what they're tasting?
That's primarily it. I mean, when I started 15 years ago in this world of food development, I was thrown into the lab here, and our lab is staffed with 35 food technologists and 8 chefs, and they were tasting foods in a way that I felt like I was unable to do. So there was something going on where they were able to get more sensory information from the food. When I use the word sensory, I mean all 5 of the senses, how we experience food through all 5 of the senses, which is what I focus on in the book. So I started to think about, well, what is it that they're experiencing that I'm not? And why is the difference here? I mean, am I just not as well endowed as they are in the tasting equipment department? Or does it have to do with their training or their experience? And so I went out and I looked for a book that was just something that would explain for non-scientific people, which I am, what is happening when you put food in your mouth and you chew and you swallow and you say you like some things and you hate others. Like, what is going on? What is happening when we taste? And I wanted just an easy reading book. And I found that that book didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I would write it.
Well, what do you find? You know, it's funny because you make some distinctions in your book. When you were talking about your initial experience, realizing that people who are professionals in the industry, some of them don't have the vocabulary to understand or understand the vocabulary to really analyze taste. And you said, you know,
and some of them talk on a level that the average layperson would never comprehend.
Right, but when you talk about addressing a group of executives at a client that had hired you, and you said, you know, you realize that this group of food professionals who was selling foods knew more about the subtlety and complexity of wine than they did of food.
That's right. Well, and that makes sense, right? Because everybody's heard of wine tasting classes and wine comparisons and vertical tastings and horizontal tastings. We do a lot of critical tasting of wine, yet we don't necessarily do the same of food.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty odd, given that only about 35% of the population in America drinks wine. But 100% of us eat food.
I would like to point out. I would like to point out that that's our favorite 35%. But I get your point. But I get your point.
Mine too. I happen to be part of that 35%. But yeah, I wanted to really kind of give the same background, the same structure, to someone who was interested in learning more about the subtleties of taste in their food. And so I spend a lot of time in the book breaking it down into its very component parts, which is the first thing that they teach you when you start to taste wine. They'll teach you to look at the visual appearance of the wine. They'll teach you to smell the wine before you even taste it. And then they'll teach you to taste it and keep it in your mouth, swish, swallow, and breathe again. All of these are the same techniques that you should use when you're eating food, but we just don't approach food in the same way, and I really wanted to change this.
Well, now, I couldn't agree more, and I think you say some things that are really reminiscent of another guest we had on the show and friend of ours, Gail Green, who always equates sex and food, you know, as using all the senses, and you do the same.
Absolutely. I mean, we take sex very seriously.
I do.
As we should.
I do.
As we should. And I'm going to guess that when you're engaged in the act, that you're not doing something like watching TV or reading a magazine or driving. And yet we do all of these activities while we're eating. And so what it does is it distracts us from this incredibly sensual act of stimulating all 5 of our senses. So I just wish that we would take food more seriously and treat it more like sex. And if we did that, we'd get so much more pleasure out of it.
And let's go back to that wine analogy just for a minute. We don't drink wine to quench our thirst.
Right.
Okay. We eat food to quell our hunger.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people eat food to quell their hunger. But if we took the same amount of time that we took on tasting wine, because it's something that we're not doing just to quench our thirst, If we did the same thing with food, if we didn't treat it as just something to sate our hunger, we could get a lot more enjoyment out of it.
Absolutely, and that is a really important distinction. I think that when you talk about eating critically and eating where it's not just to satisfy your hunger, most people think about dining out in restaurants and fine situations where you're paying very much attention to your food. But I'm arguing that those other 99.9% of the occasions where you're eating at your desk or you're eating lunch at the office or you're eating breakfast at home or whatever the occasion is, that if you started to think about that occasion and that ability and opportunity to suck more sensory pleasure out of your food, we might get more pleasure out of it and as a result eat less of it and eat less of the crap that we eat in this country.
You know, let me ask you a question. I think this begs an interesting question. Because there's this picture of a guy sitting on a couch watching a movie sort of mindlessly, you know, eating something out of a bag. Do you think that the culture that we have of constantly being entertained by either a television or a movie or the computer or at our desk while we're eating...
Multitasking.
Do you think that gives... some food makers who don't care so much about quality, you think it makes it easier for them to pass off just the simplest, most garish flavors? You know, you give me salt, give me sweet, give me crunchy, and, you know, you don't have to pay much attention because the person who's eating it's not paying that much attention.
You know, I think that's a really, really insightful thought. I've never really thought about that, but of course it's got to be true. I think if we were more discriminating in the foods that we choose, and we had a little bit more education as to what a good, clean, well-balanced flavor was, that we would reject a lot of the foods that are in the masses today. And, you know, I know this firsthand because I'm involved with large food companies, and, you know, that there are certain customers that are just not discriminating about their food.
Right.
And that's a shame, and
right.
I'd like to change that.
Barbie, you use a word, and you know, you talk about it a lot in the book, and Francis and I have been talking about it for 20 years. The word is balance. I mean, I remember early in our years of running our restaurants, talking to a chef and talking to him about, you know, making a dish better, fixing the dish. The dish wasn't quite right. And he said, oh, I'll just add some more butter. You know, I'll make it richer. I'll make it fattier. And Francis and I were like, no, that's not what this dish needs.
Although, if you're at home and you've just ruined the dish, throw a stick of butter in there and it'll probably be edible, you know.
But we were like, no, we're talking about making this dish more balanced.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not talking about necessarily making this dish rich.
Palatable in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're talking about making it balanced and making it pop and making all the flavors come out together. And we talk about it in wine all the time, and I know we're going to talk a lot about how we treat wine versus how we treat food here, but we talk about it in wine all the time. We talk about balance in wine being the mm-hmm. most important thing. It's the most important thing in food as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I use this mnemonic device of a five-pointed star. And at the tips of each of the points of the star are the five basic tastes: sweet, sour, bitter, salt, and umami. Or savory. And that, when I first started learning the very basics of taste, and I learned that there were only five things that we can detect using the sense of taste without help from any of the other senses, I realized that, wait a second, so I need to start thinking about these five tastes and how they balance each other out. And that was really an aha to me. That's when I created the star. And now when I'm tasting food, I'm thinking, I'm going through my fingers, which also I happen to have five of those, and I'm thinking, is the sweetness in balance? Is the sourness in balance? Is the salt in balance? Is there bitterness here? Should it be here? Should it be higher? Should it be lower? And, of course, is the umami right for this dish? And then when you start thinking about things in that, you know, those terms, if you get those five basic tastes right and you get them in balance, everything else is really easy.
You know, it's funny, you know, you're reminding me of, I've worked with young chefs in the past, and I'm thinking of one chef in particular who used to say to me, you know, every time I come down here, you're like, it needs olive oil or it needs salt. I'm like, that's exactly correct. That's because every time you bring me a dish, you know, let's talk about, because you cover this in the book, when there's sort of a level of when everything is in balance, it's good food. But when stuff really pops, you know, for me, very often I'll find professionals even, and certainly at home, they make great food, but they haven't salted it properly. And salt is like, you know, a gram makes it all the difference in the world. And they haven't, and they haven't added the, I guess it's the umami that you get from the olive oil and the bright aromas and the bitterness that comes from a good, sharp olive oil. What makes a flavor pop scientifically?
Well, there's a lot of things that make a flavor pop, but I think it goes back to balance. And I talked to a lot of chefs when I was writing this book, a lot of very successful chefs in San Francisco, and I asked them the same question, like, what makes food pop? And they think about tastes and flavors a lot differently than I do, but it sort of always kind of came back to these two things, and that was acid and salt. Acid and salt. And most foods, if you think about it, have at least some acid and at least some salt. And they sort of enhance each other and accentuate each other. But you can't stop there. You can't really just say that acid and salt make a food pop, because we know that something that's plainly acidic or plainly salty or just acidic and salty doesn't necessarily pop in the right way, in a good way. It's the balance of the acidity and salt in relation to the other tastes, the sweetness, the bitterness, and the umami. And I think that thing that makes it pop, that quintessential quality, that is not the same for every food. And so it's really, it's an almost ethereal thing that it's like, you know, it's like the Supreme Court said about pornography, right?
You know,
I don't know what
it
is, but I'll know it when I see it. Or in this case, I know it when I'll smell it, and I'll know it when I taste it. And so you just have to have that sense of what that quality is. And that, I think, comes from the ability and the understanding of balance.
Mark and I do a lot of beverage teaching and beverage training, whether it's spirits or beer or wine. But certainly in wine, there are things that we understand, and I don't know whether they're, you know, artificial distinctions that we've made in our mind, but the way that we understand tasting, the way that we in the wine community understand tasting wine, we always point to the structure of a wine and then everything else. And so the structure of the wine is the acid and tannin, or the acid and the bitterness, more or less, sort of. We'll go with that for now. Is the acid and tannin of the wine, and everything else sort of hangs on that structure, whether it's sweetness and sort of the interesting fruit flavors and all the bells and whistles that make it great.
They become the artwork.
Is there a similar thing in food? Is there a structure that we begin with, and then we build complexity on that structure?
Yes, and I think that the what you're talking about with wine, the structure, the acidity, and the tannin, you're starting to talk about the senses and the taste. And so let's talk about, first of all, the difference between taste and flavor, and then I'm going to tie this all together. But the difference between taste and flavor is that taste is only five things. It's sweet, sour, bitter, salt, and umami. So if you're not experiencing one of those things, that's not taste. It's something else. The word we use to describe flavor, this flavor is what we're usually talking about when you say, I like the taste of something. Really, you mean that I like the flavor of it. And flavor encompasses two other senses. Those senses are the sense of smell and the sense of touch. And so when you talk about the structure of a wine, you're talking about the acid, which is one of the basic tastes, the tannin, which tannin sometimes goes along with bitter, but tannin is not bitterness.
Right.
Tannin is actually astringency or texture.
Right.
And smell and aroma. And that smell is what comes through your nostrils when you stick your nose in the glass. But even more importantly, it's what comes from the back of your throat when you put the wine in your mouth and swish and swallow, and the aromas go up through your nose. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on there, but essentially what we're talking about with a wine that tastes good is that it has the proper structure from the basic tastes of, usually those tastes are sweet and sour.
Mm-hmm.
It has the proper textural component, which in the case of red wines is usually a nice balanced level of tannin. And then it has the aromas, which come from the ripeness of the fruit and the type of varietal and whether or not you've aged in oak and whether or not you've manipulated the wine in some other way. And so those three senses together give you the flavor of wine. Now, if you switch over to food, it's exactly the same thing. Food has basic tastes. They sort of give you the outline of the food. And then what fills in the center and what really what makes it that artwork that you mentioned is the aromas and the texture. And that is a way that I hope to teach people to start thinking about food in terms of setting up the structure of the food with the basic tastes and filling it in with the textural components and the aroma.
Barb, we, a long time ago, Francis and I did this really cool seminar where we were comparing taste versus what you're actually smelling.
Olfactory senses. Whether through your nose or what they call, what you were describing earlier, the retronasal olfactory senses, where you're basically smelling up through your sinuses what's
and,
in your
and
mouth.
I think every person in America knows about the five senses on their tongue, or at least four of the senses on their tongue. But
you mean the taste?
I'm sorry,
taste.
Tastes, yes. But I think we don't really appreciate it. And you put a test in your book, and Francis and I did this test years ago, and it was amazing to me. What the test was is they gave you a nose clip, and they put the nose clip on your nose, and they gave you something to taste.
Yeah.
And we tasted it. It was very simple. It was obviously like a powdered sugar or something like that. That's what it tastes like, just sugar. Okay. Literally, you take the thing off your nose as you're finishing swallowing what's in your mouth, and you realize that it's cinnamon sugar.
Right.
And because we don't have the ability to perceive the smell of cinnamon without our nose,
it's just sugar.
It was just sugar. And I think people don't realize how that this is real. It's not like, oh, you only taste these things and you get some other flavors, but they're minimal. It is, I mean, this is a hard and fast thing, isn't it?
It really is, and it sometimes takes doing that exercise to make a believer out of someone. I mean, even restaurateurs like yourself, or chefs, or food technologists, or people that have been in the business for years, they take it so for granted because they have this instinctive or instinctual understanding of how flavors work, but they forget that taste is really simple. Taste is five things.
Right.
And without your sense of smell, those five things can be pretty darn boring.
Yeah. We think we perceive more with our tongue than we do.
And you know exactly. You of course know why you can understand why the confusion. It's because we put food in our mouth. We don't put food in our nose. You know, hopefully.
Well, Mark did when he was small. He used to piss his mother
off. The occasional pee.
Hey, listen, Barb, we need to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side. We're talking with Barb Stuckey about her book, Taste What You're Missing. And if you haven't read the book, you are missing. It's The Passionate Eater's Guide to Why Good Food Tastes Good. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Don't go away. There's more.
The 7th Annual Chefs Congress is going to be held in New York City from September 30th through October 2nd, and that's just a few weeks away. Now, the Chefs Congress is a really cool event. It's a 3-day symposium put on every year by StarChefs.com. It's a huge learning experience and a networking opportunity. Some of the best and the brightest luminaries in the food, wine, and cocktail world are going to be there. Mario Batali, John Besh, Masaharu Morimoto, Marcus Samuelson, Johnny Uzzini, Jim Meehan, Audrey Saunders, you know, the people who've been on our show, all in one place, a culinary gathering of epic proportions. Seminars and classes and opportunity to meet all these folks, you got to check it out. Go to starchefs.com/ICC to learn more about it. If you want to buy tickets, use the code ICC199. That's for Restaurant Guys listeners to get a special price of $199 for the 3-day symposium. More than you think you could ever learn in 3 days. We'll be there. We hope to see you. Starchefs.com/ICC and use the discount code ICC199. We'll see you there.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. Mark's actually putting some food in his nose right now, and our guest is...
I'm going to put some food in your nose.
That's why it's radio. You don't know. You don't know if I'm telling the truth or not. We're talking with Barb Stuckey about her book, Taste. All sorts of fun facts in this book. And before we get to some of the fun facts, I think you cover in the science of food. And, you know, this is a science book written for the layman, which is really fantastic. You know,
well,
you don't
it's good
need to
Francis and I are laymen.
You avoided science classes. But you explain the scientific principles, and you give evidence for what you say, right? So that's part of what's going on in this book.
Yeah, I'm really trying to appeal to someone who I call a curious eater.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be into science at all. In fact, I'm not that interested in science myself. But I wanted to understand what was happening, and to understand what's happening when you put food in your mouth and you make a judgment, it really helps to understand the science that underlies it all. But I basically tell stories. I mean, that's what the book is about. And so I'm telling stories that illustrate the concepts, and hopefully they're easy to digest.
And one of the things I like about the book is you tell stories, but you also back it up with, I mean, it's more the mechanics of taste as well. And then,
yes.
You know, the stories illustrate that. You talk to stories about people who are compromised in some way or have their tastes change. Talk to us about, I mean, you talk about people who take drugs or high on drugs and how that affects
right.
their taste. People, pregnant people, folks with Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease and what that does to their taste. Talk to us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the ways to really appreciate how much we get from our food when it relates to a single sense is to talk to someone who doesn't have that sense. And so I went out and I talked to people who were deaf and people who were blind, and I ate in the dark, and I ate without my hearing, and I ate with my hearing accentuated in an anechoic chamber. And every time I talked to people who were missing one of their senses, it to me what it did is it really just hammered home how without one of our senses, our experience of food is incomplete. And my favorite story from the book is, because everybody will know this brand, but it's about these two guys who set out to create some ice cream. And they wanted to make a super premium ice cream that would be widely appealing. And as they were developing the ice cream, one of the guys, who happened to be lacking his sense of smell, and so, of course, that means he got a whole lot less flavor from the food, he kept saying to the other guy, add more stuff, add more chunks, add more swirls, add more nuts. Because he was missing the sense of smell, he was trying to replace that sensory experience with another sense, which was the textural sense.
But it worked, because I really liked the chunks and the swirls and the stuff like that.
In Harry and Tom's ice cream. There's a famous brand. You haven't had Harry and Tom's? It's amazing. So.
Yeah, exactly. But, of course, I'm talking about Ben and Jerry's. And
no.
And it was Ben Cohen's anosmia, which is the fancy word for a lack of sense of smell, that put them in this place. And I just feel like that's the kind of story that really illustrates to us how important every one of the senses are. And without one of them, your experience of food just changes.
Well,
and that's one of the points I'm trying to make.
And also you talk about, though, how everyone's perception of food, even if they have all their senses, it's different and it can be altered by things that happen to you. So what happens to pregnant women in taste? We all have the stereotype in our head of the woman who, you know, has a craving
pickles
for
and
pickles
ice
and ice cream. What's happening
right.
when a woman gets pregnant? What happens to her sense of taste?
Well, you want
to
swirl those two together.
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
sorry,
right.
Barb.
Oh, that would be fun ice cream for Ben and Jerry's. Pickles and ice cream?
I'm out.
Pregnancy?
I'm out. I'm all out. Anyway, so what happens to pregnant women and how does it affect their taste?
Well, the problem with testing women when they're pregnant is that we don't get a lot of access to women in their first trimester. And this is usually when we get the most complaints about odd cravings or odd sensory experiences. And, of course, that's because many people don't know they're pregnant until the second or third month, and so you can't very well get them into a testing lab. So we don't have a lot of information on the first trimester. In the second and third trimesters, we do have a little bit of scientific data, and to be quite honest, it doesn't show that there is that much of a difference in sense of smell than normally, you know, than the people are normally experiencing. It just hasn't been borne out by the science. Of course, we've all heard the anecdotal stuff that people crave odd things and people's sense of smell are much more acute when they're pregnant. We just haven't been able to prove that very well. So there may be something else going on, and it just may be an a, heightened awareness of it that is somehow coming from the brain and not from the sense of smell or not from the sense of taste. But, you know, that we don't know a whole lot about what happens in the brain, but clearly something is happening that is not necessarily attributable to the sense of smell or taste.
Well, Barb, I'll give you some more anecdotal stuff to look at because my wife was pregnant, you know, four different times with each of our kids, and she craved different foods with each of our children. But I think something that, you know, bears looking into, what she craved with our final child wasn't salty or sweet or pickles or umami. She craved crunchy, and she searched out things that were thick and crunchy, and she needed that texture to satisfy herself.
That's so interesting.
It was really interesting to watch, and I didn't spend any time studying at all. I gave her the crunchy thing she wanted.
The crunchy thing. All right, so let's talk about something. What happens when people are on drugs? You talk about in your book when people are high on drugs, it affects their perception of food.
Well, yeah, I actually did a little bit of pseudoscience in the preparation for this book, and we went out and, you know, bear in mind we're in Northern California here, and we did a little what we call a lack of focus group.
Awesome.
Where everybody...
welcome to the dinner table with Francis and me.
Yeah.
So we got everybody high on marijuana. And the point was to try and prove whether...
I'm shocked, Barb. I'm shocked. We're ending the interview right now. Right now, you're off the show. No, go ahead.
Luckily, you all had glaucoma, so yeah. It was okay.
Yes, it was medicinal.
And it was cured after that dinner. Fantastic. All right, so everybody got buzzed. And before you devoured the 37 bags of potato chips afterwards, how did it change your perception of flavor?
Right. Well, so we did some testing before anybody could get their hands on anything inebriating because we had to set a baseline.
Right.
And then we got everybody high, and then we had them taste the same foods while they were high. And the point was to prove or disprove this myth that you get the munchies and food just tastes so amazing when you're high. And it turns out that there's been quite a bit of real science, not pseudoscience done, but there's been quite a bit of real science done in this area of study. What we found in our little pseudoscience experiment was that when you're high, you get mostly basic tastes from your food, and you're focused very much on the basic tastes,
mm-hmm.
the sweetness, the saltiness. And you seem to have a somewhat blurred or missing sense of clarity when it comes to textural components and aromas. And so things just become much simpler when you're high.
Everything
at least that was our experience.
From my own experience, not that I've ever done this, but it seems a little simpler. Something like...
If we pull that quote out of this show and kind of post it as kind of the byline, you won't mind.
I'd like
it simpler when you're high.
I'd like to sum it up as this Ben and Jerry's is so good.
It's the best thing I've ever tasted.
Exactly. It's delicious. Chunky monkeys, a little pizza. Sorry. I agree with your findings. Dr. Stuckey. Let's talk about, and please feel free to invite the restaurant guys to your next experiment. next experimental session, we'll come to California. Now, let's talk about other things, though. A fun fact out of your book, noise can affect, if there's loud noise in the background, it affects how you taste things. Is that correct?
Yes.
What's that all about?
Yeah, and I think the sense of hearing is probably the least appreciated when it comes to our experience of food. And, you know, usually when we talk about the sound of food, we're talking about music that's playing in the background of a restaurant, which in fact does have an effect on your experience, and I write about that as well. But what's more important and what's more interesting to me is what ambient noise can do in the background and what the sound from the food, what the noise from the food can communicate to you. And so with regard to the first, it turns out that Lufthansa, when they're testing their foods for flight, they actually simulate the environment of a plane. So they have this grounded fuselage that they pipe in the sound from the jet engine, and they dry the air out like it is when you're up at 30,000 feet, and they do all of these different things to simulate that environment. And one of the things that they've learned is that when you have those two jet engines blaring on the side of the fuselage, that that noise, just the fact that that loud noise is there, what you're going to experience from the taste of the food is that they're going to be much more muted. So we say that
and if you're high
loud,
and if you're high at the same time, it's just not, you know, it doesn't taste like anything at all. I'm sorry, go right ahead.
So what we take away from this experience is that really loud ambient sound in the background can have a masking effect on taste. Now, they didn't test flavors, so they didn't test necessarily texture, they didn't test aroma, but we can assume that sound will have a similar masking effect.
But let's take that to its next logical step,
sure.
Barb. I mean, we are, as human beings, we're easily distracted. We talked about having the television on. We talked about all those other things that prevent us from really tasting food. Now you've added noise. Okay.
Right.
Well, you know, on some level, we're paying attention to the noise. And that is distracting us from what we're eating. Right. You only have so much bandwidth. Exactly.
That's exactly right. And I love that word, distraction. I think that one of the simplest things that people can do, and everybody always asks me, how can I be a better taster? The simplest thing you can do is pay attention.
You know,
focus.
You talk about the sounds of food itself, and you write in your book that our ears are acutely attuned to sound and the sound of food, and you say that, you know, you've shown that a human being can, if they don't, you don't really think about it, but they can tell the difference between pouring a kettle of hot water or a kettle of cold water. You can tell the difference in what it sounds like.
Yes, and I've done this experiment with hundreds of people, and everyone gets it right. And if your listeners want to do it, they can go to my website, and we have the audio files there.
That's so
but
cool.
But it's shocking. I know. It's the coolest thing in the world. You wouldn't think that hot water sounds different than cold water, but it does.
Plug for the website.
And you'll know.
Plug for the website. What's the website?
Plug for the website is barbstuckey.com, BARBSTUCKEY.
I'm going to do that, by the way. We'll also put that link up at Restaurant Guys Radio, so you can go to one place, and you should really pick up this book. It's really fascinating.
It was really interesting. You know, Barb, obviously, you're really interesting. It's the science here is, you know, it's something you can intuit, but like you said, nobody wrote it down. Nobody put it on the pages, and nobody said, here, this is how it really works.
And I love to read a book where I go, and, you know, Mark and I have been paying attention to food. I mean, we were in college, we were paying attention to food, and we've owned our own restaurants for 20 years. But I remember it was our first trip to Italy together after we'd opened the restaurant. We went with Mark and Mark's wife, and Mark is a huge pastry fan and a huge cannoli fan. And I remember...
It's funny. Yeah.
I remember. You remember what I'm talking about?
I know the story.
We were in Verona. We're in downtown Verona, and we found a pastry shop that made cannolis. Now, Mark, we still get great cannolis from Manhattan and from Brooklyn, and we make great cannolis in our own restaurant. But we hadn't had an Italian restaurant at that time. And Mark went in and got a cannoli, and he was like... It was like the Holy Grail. He's like, and he says, with a mouth half full of cannoli, that's it. That's what I'm talking about. And he closes his mouth and he chews and he points at his cheek. He wants me to listen to his cheek because the cannoli shell was crunching just perfectly.
Oh,
and
I
you
love
know what?
That
is what makes a great cannoli. It's the textural. It's the textural difference in your mouth.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. That textural contrast, as we call it, is something that human beings love. And anytime you can create a textural contrast between something that's, for example, really creamy and sweet and soft in the middle and crunchy and crisp on the outside, those two things together make for a really nicely balanced combination that we tend to love.
Listen,
and there's so many things out
dynamic
there like
contrast
that.
Is why we love ice cream cones. It's
right.
Why we love Oreo cookies. I
you,
mean, it's all those things.
You know, when we do pastry in the restaurant and you make a gelée or something, the gelée should, and you put it on your tongue, the heat of your tongue should turn it back into a liquid. It should, you know, when you get ice cream from home, take that Ben & Jerry's pint out of the freezer for 15 minutes, or if you've just come from an experiment at Barb Stuckey's, you can put it in the oven at like 200 degrees to get it cooler faster.
Right.
But you want it like where it's just about to melt, you know? And that is just really, really
you know,
amazing.
Why don't I enjoy pâté unless I have it with a crouton?
Right.
Okay? I don't enjoy
exactly.
pâté unless I have it with something crunchy.
I'm with you on that foie gras as well. And I think one of the things that you're talking about is the eating food at the correct temperature, and that is really important. And one of the things that is, for example, ice cream is formulated so that it tastes perfect when it's frozen. If you were to thaw ice cream and you know, let it thaw into a liquid, and you tasted that ice cream when it was at room temperature, it would taste horrible. It would taste way too sweet. It would taste way too creamy. And that is because it's formulated specifically to be eaten at a frozen temperature. Now, what happens when you eat something at the proper temperature, and that might require warming it up a little bit or letting it melt a little bit on your counter, is that the texture, of course, changes, but also the volatile aromas, or the aroma molecules that give it its signature aroma, they become much more active at room temperature or at hotter temperatures. And so you really are getting more aroma from warmer food. More aroma translates into more flavor. So warmer food has more flavor.
And one of the things we can do in the restaurant, which, you know, you just don't have the advantage of when you're buying something off a shelf, is we can adjust our we know what temperature we're going to sell our ice creams at.
Right, so we
can adjust the flavors in our ice cream so that the flavor you're going to, the temperature you're going to eat it at is the flavor,
is what we
is
want,
the flavor
yeah.
that we want.
You know, and just to point out, I mean, if you want proof of this, my dad was ill for a long time before he passed away, for about 18 months, and so I spent a lot of time outside of Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And, you know, it would be a marathon affair, you know, and I'd be bored. And there was always a Mr. Softy truck parked out in front of the – and I thought, you know, I remember not liking that very much as a kid, but I'm going to go and have myself a Mr. Softy. It was like 90 degrees, and I went and I got myself a Mr. Softy ice cream cone. And I licked it, and it wasn't very good. So I wasn't really that into it, but I was looking for a garbage can to throw it away, and I walked around, and it's 90 degrees out, and I'm like, it's not melting. It's not changing. And so as an experiment, I sat there, and it sort of eventually got meltish. And, you know, if you look at, I'll name another brand, Seal Test Ice Cream. You know, you take it out, and it's got that little corner, like it's a corner of the box. And I haven't done this in years, so maybe it's changed. But as it melts, if you leave it in a bowl and melt, it will retain its structure to a very warm temperature. And go to a lot of fast food restaurants. Get a thick shake. Thick shake is not a milkshake. It's a thick shake. It's made of thick. And and you know, let it get warm, and it often remains thick. Well, not only is that a problem, I'll tell you there's something fake in your food, but it also says one of the things that falls flat about those things is I don't get the dynamic contrast. It doesn't turn to clean liquid on my palate. It turns to grease. It turns to you know, and I don't know. I find that you can, that dynamic contrast is very important. And in the cheapest of cheap foods, that's what you lose.
Yes, and that ability of something to start melting when it hits your tongue, that generally that's an inborn response. You know, we're born with the response of liking that textural change, because it generally signals the presence of fat. And so, you know, things that are fat will change from solid to liquid when you just apply the heat of your mouth. And so those things are very, very positive to us. I don't know, because I don't know anything about Mr. Softy, but I'm guessing that white stuff, whatever it was much lower in fat than most normal ice cream.
Well,
and so when you tasted it, it just tasted wrong.
Right. And, you know, it's designed to be, I'm like, you know, it's a 90-degree day. They're making this on a truck. How do they, and that truck is in the sun. How do they do that? Well, they do it by creating a thing that doesn't melt and can
Francis,
stay stable.
There's another thing that you may not be aware of.
What's that?
It's called refrigeration.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they can
but
do that now.
But you know, that's the thing. It wasn't that cold. You know, I think it was just anyway. So enough about Mr. Softy. Here's a question that, you know, after reading your book, that I sort of think about. Maybe it's a philosophical question. Maybe it's nothing you can answer, but you might want to let us know what you think about it. Is the best food always complex? Is that the difference? I mean, because look, you can make a tortilla chip and it's crunch and it's salt and it's okay and you know it's all right, but to be really great, does food need to be complex?
I do not think so at all.
Okay.
No. In fact, I'm at a point in my dining career where I used to review restaurants, and I've been eating professionally for 15 years. I am at a point in my dining career where the fancier and fussier and more structured and higher the concept when it comes to food, the less likely I am to crave it. And so, you know, what do I crave? Well, I crave a big bowl of really properly cooked pasta with a simple drizzle of green olive oil and some kosher salt and a shaving of fresh Parmesan, aged Parmesan cheese. And to me, that is craveable. Now, that doesn't mean that when I go to these molecular gastronomy restaurants or I go to very fancy Michelin-starred restaurants, that doesn't mean that I don't have a great experience. I do. But it's not the food I crave. So I think you have to make that distinction between really good food. Is the food at these upscale restaurants, is it good? Absolutely. Do you crave it? Probably not. And probably the reason you don't is because it's so complex.
All right, I want to posit another question and maybe look at that same question a little differently. Isn't a peach really complex?
That's exactly where I was going.
Isn't the flavor of a peach really complex?
I think we were talking about, you know, okay, you get the peach in the supermarket, it's like, it's okay, it's kind of peachy. But when you get that, like, white peach in August from the right, grown in the right soils, I'm talking about that flavor itself. It's just, to me, that is just like, it's not just sweet. It's almost indescribable to me. And that's
complex. I mean, it's got acidity, it's got texture,
well,
it's got...
That's what we think, but what do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. And generally, what will be different between that supermarket peach that doesn't have a lot of peachiness going on and the perfectly ripe peach that you pluck off of the tree from, you know, the countryside and eat warm from the tree, the difference between those two will be the amount and intensity of the volatile aromas that are present. Probably it'll be a little bit softer, too, so there's a slight difference in the texture. It might have more sweetness because it's been allowed to stay on the vine longer to develop a little bit more sweetness. But the really big difference, if you were to cut this peach up and puree it and run it through a gas chromatography, mass spectrometry.
Which I do very often.
Right, most people have at home.
In the basement.
That would tell you that really, really perfect ripe peach is just loaded with those really volatile aromas that give it that peachy, fuzzy, fruity, green, sulfury, all of the aromas that come together and say peachy. It has more of that going on.
Well, Barb Stuckey, we think you're just peachy. Thanks for coming on our show today. Mark,
I'm hanging my head in disgust, Barb. I'm sorry. Not at you, but at Francis's
comments. That was a lob. I couldn't let that go by. Barb, seriously, your book is great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. It was really fun.
Barb Stuckey's book is Taste, What You're Missing, The Passionate Eater's Guide to Why Good Food Tastes Great. Pick it up. It's a fantastic read, and check it out on the Restaurant Guys.
Thanks,
Barb.
At
restaurantguysradio.com.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a minute. Don't you dare go away.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis.
Great book. You know, Francis and I talk about books a lot. This is one that you should get because it was interesting and dynamic and had lots of information that was easy to read and easy to digest, no pun intended. You know, we talked about something earlier.
You
in the
intended
show.
That pun. You intended that pun. I'm calling you out on that. It was an intended pun. Go ahead.
We talked about something earlier in the show, and I didn't want to interrupt Barb and tell this story, but way back when, you know, she talked about the perception of food.
Mm-hmm.
Way back when, I took a trip to Egypt as a young man, and I ate in a place in a nightclub, and it was very dark.
Mm.
And, you know, I ordered the chicken, and probably wasn't chicken, and it was very disconcerting for me.
Mm-hmm.
And eating in the dark, it was really an uncomfortable experience for me. I mean, it wasn't pitch black, but I really couldn't see the intricate details of what I was eating.
Yeah.
And I ate, and it was fine, and I didn't get sick or anything like that. But I will say that to this day, I don't enjoy eating if I can't see my food.
Because it was a mouse that you ate. Oh, mouse, did you order the chicken? Here you go.
I'm pretty sure that mouse is a kind word for what I was eating. But like I said, besides that, it's really true. I mean,
send the rat to table 24.
Turn the lights out and eat something that somebody else has prepared for you. And give it a try. It's not as pleasurable as it is to eat when you're looking at your food. It just isn't.
And we're going to leave you with this note. You know, one of the great things about a restaurant and one of the reasons the food tastes so great in a restaurant is a lot of it's what we do and when you pick a great restaurant and you're paying attention in a restaurant. We make sure the music's right. We make sure the lights are right. And you put away your iPhone, turn off the television, turn off the stereo, talk with the person across from you. And we love when you come to our restaurants and do that, but you can do that on your own at home, right? So turn off your iPhone for 15 minutes.
Focus on having dinner.
Focus on having dinner and talking with somebody you love. And if three people do that as a result of this show, we'll have done our day's work for today. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We're the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.